connector on the end of the RG6, which is designed for it. And then Radio Shack also sells an adapter that goes from F connector to anything else you want, F to BNC, F to UHF, and so on. That's one possible approach. Another possible approach is the ordinary PL259. There's a version of it where there is an extra screw-in device on the back end, which allows you to put in a smaller diameter cable. The PL259 connector is made for something that's 4/10 of an inch in diameter, RG8 cable, and the RG6 is about half that diameter. They make an adapting device that screws into the back end that has a smaller diameter. So any connector that you like, type N connector, type UHF, or PL259, or F connector, there's various combinations. What's the best one? Let's see what Mel's got to say on that one. I bet you've had a question like this, Mel. K2KEY, how would you solve that one? K2LIW in the TechNet.
The reducing adapter is for RG8X, which is almost exactly the same size as the RG6 into YJC.
Okay, that's the answer. All right, so the reducing adapter, which I presume is also a Radio Shack product that we'll see in the bubble packs. Is that true?
Yeah, it should be. It's, the RG8, which is equivalent to the LMR240, will accept RG6, and I think Radio Shack carries it.
Okay, let me pass it over briefly to Mel to see if he's got any further suggestions on this. And if not, I'm going to go back to Brandon one more time. Over to you first, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, well, good old BNC connectors. Amphenol has a whole bunch of them in the catalog that'll adapt to any cable. You can even get BNC connectors that I've used that'll go from RG8 to BNC. And you say, wow, look at the difference, because you never thought of seeing a BNC connector hanging on the end of a piece of RG8 cable, but they are making BNCs to go to just about any cable that you possibly can come up with. And I like BNC connectors, Dick, especially with the ones that they supply you with that center pin that's separate that you can, well, they tell you crimp it on, but it's very easy to also to make a great connection by soldering it on over.
Okay, as I see it, Brandon, you've got at least two approaches there. The one that Lou just gave you, N2YJC, the one that Mel just gave you. One of the things you should know ahead of time, Brandon, when you listen to other ham radio operators other than Mel and Dick, you will hear all kinds of tall stories about the insertion loss of various connectors. Almost all of that is hogwash. I know that's a pretty strong statement. The way you get lost in a transmission line is it must have length. And a connector has no real length. I mean, the average connector is under an inch long. Unless you build it out of carbon granules, it cannot have loss unless you've created an open circuit because you forgot to solder it and there's an air gap in there or something like that. So don't worry about the insertion loss of the connector. A BNC connector, which is a very convenient one, and an F connector, I would trust them to at least 100 watts, maybe 200 watts, before you're getting into any kind of trouble. When you start running 1,000 watts, yes, you better use a larger connector. But and there the failure is only because of current flowing through the center pin creating extra heat when you run the 1,000 watts. So don't worry about insertion loss. You're putting a connector on the end of a cable just for physical reasons to make contact, and ultimately you're going to wrap some tape around it to make sure the one that's outdoors doesn't get water down the connector. So there's lots of combinations that will work, and if worse comes to worse, there are guys who have made a homebrew connector with hose clamps and pieces of plumbing fittings that they get out of the hardware store. I don't recommend you do that at first, but know that it would work if you did do it. So whatever connector you run into first that's convenient for you probably can made to me.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I did it again. Oh, well. guys are going to get mad at me. I hope you're still there, Brandon. Whatever connect you use, it's nowhere near as much of a problem as you think. Please don't put the stub in there at first. It's a little bit more complicated than first meets the eye. Keep it simple, and the stub is going to give you such a small amount of improvement that at first, in my opinion, it isn't worth it. It's more trouble than it's worth, unless you're doing some real serious scientific work, so to speak. Hope you're still hearing me, Brandon. KB1, THM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more bit of information.
I'll say, hang in there, Brandon. Go ahead, Lou.
I just realized RG8X is very popular in the marine world for the guys with the boats. And if he has trouble finding a regular PL-259 with the RG8X reducer, I know that they carry them over at like a place like West Marine or any marine supply place that that carries marine electronics. So that should be a real easy place for him to find that connector. Dick, that's 2YJ, say go ahead.
2RSO with a comment.
Ms. Jen, 2RSO, go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. This is Frank, N2RSO, and given the construction of RG6, the fact that it's it uses aluminum foil, I think your original suggestion is the best one. Terminate each end with an F-connector. Use a good compression fitting. Be aware that there are two different types of RG6 cable. There's the regular version, and then there's a quad shield, and the connectors do differ. So make sure you have the right connectors for the particular cable that you're using. And again, your suggestion, terminate in both ends with F connectors, and then use an adapter, which are readily available at the Radio Shack and other electronic stores, to go, basically it's a female F to a PL-259, which is probably the way he wants to go, UHF connector. But it sounds to me like the easiest way to go. No soldering involved. Just crimp on that F, plug in the screw on the adapter, and you're ready to go. Back to Ned in 2 hours, so.
Take DTZ with comments.
Hal, let me drop one enough. Stand by.
Hal recognized. There's a couple of other things here, though, Frank, we've got to worry about. Number one, to do a good job of putting the F connector made for RG6 on that foil type cable, it's foil plus a braid, requires a crimping tool. And Radio Shack sells a very cheap crimping tool that does a fairly poor job. The really good crimping tool, the one that's got the nice big jaws, is about an $18 expense just for the darn crimping tool. I'm going to pass it back to you, Frank, for a quick comment first before we go over to Hal, and that is, of all the cables, assuming that Brandon hasn't yet purchased the RG6, maybe he's already got it, we'll find that out in a minute, but if he hasn't already purchased the RG6, is there any other cable you would recommend that he buy, like maybe RG8 Mini or whatever, that will make the crimping problem a little bit easier? I'm worrying that it's a real art form to properly do the crimping with the right tool. And I've seen some really terrible connectors on the end for a person who doesn't have some experience. N2RSO, some further comments on that. K2RIW, you got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick. Basically, if he hasn't purchased the cable yet, he probably would be better off going with RG8X, or as Radio Shack calls it, RG8M or Mini. Much easier to put on a connector. And I agree with you about the crimping tool, the one that Radio Shack sells. I believe they have two or three different varieties. You need to use a very heavy-duty one. I know the cable vision guys use what looks like a fairly new tool that exerts quite a bit of pressure, and I think they're using special F connectors now as well. You do want to get a good crimp on it. For that reason, if he has not yet bought the cable and wants to go with the 75 ohm RG6, they do sell it already terminated. You can buy a 50-foot length with the F-connectors already installed. And I imagine they use some kind of a hydraulic press to squeeze those things on. So, again, the question remains whether he has purchased the cable yet or has a sufficient length of RG6 and wants to experiment with it. Then if he can beg, borrow, I won't say steal, a good quality crimping tool, I still say that's the way to go. Back to you, Dick, and to RSO.
Yeah, that crimping tool, the big heavy one they sell at Radio Shack for around $18, does an extremely good job. But this thing is a 2-pound chunk of steel. It's a massive thing. And it's a little bit pricey for a guy that's first getting into ham radio. If you're going to be installing a lot of F connectors around the house or running cables all over the place, it's a good investment. But if you're just doing it once, it's not such a good investment. To buy the version of the cable that has the connectors already installed, and some of those versions have a weatherproofed version of the F connector already installed. And there's one other option you've got. If you really decide you like F connector RG6 cable, and it's not bad, and if they only have 50-foot lengths and 25-foot lengths, and you've got to go 75, don't forget that there's a way you can do it with an adapter. They make an F connector at Radio Shack in the bubble packs. It's a female-to-female F connector, and therefore you could take a piece of 50-foot long and a piece of 25-foot long, for instance, and mate the two together with that connector. You better wrap it pretty good with a coax seal or a duct seal-like material and tape to keep the water out. You don't want the water getting into that adapter. But to stretch a piece of cable with F connectors at Radio Shack is quite easy, in my opinion. Consider that as a possible option. Hal wanted to give you some words of wisdom. Here we go. K6DPZ, K2RIW. You got it, Hal. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, I wait for the beeps. K2RIW. That's K6DPZ. Yeah, my comment was, if you use two Q-sections, which you can make out of RG58 on each side of that cable you're working with, you'd be able to go in with inserts in the into PL259s to get a 50-ohm match. How's that, Dick?
For you and me, Hal, that's easy. To give all the proper information for all about adapting, connecting, and whatever for those Q-sections. For a person who is in ham radio for, let's say, a short period of time, you would recommend it, I would not recommend it. And Brandon's going to make his own decision as to which way he wants to go. My strongest recommendation is keep it simple with as few connectors as possible. The more connectors you put outdoors, unless you've got a lot of experience with good weatherproofing techniques, you can easily end up with water in the connector. Water at 2 meters can give you quite a few decibels of loss. In the case of 432, which he's going to eventually go there, I know that a couple of drops, 2 drops of water, in the center of a type N connector on 432 gives you more than 10 decibels of signal loss. That's a 10-to-1 ratio. It's a lot. And if you think you're going to foolishly take an RIW parallel kilowatt amplifier with 700 watts output and you're going to simply bake away the water, foolish decision. Doesn't work. Been there, done that. Don't go there. That's another whole story. So, Brandon, my recommendation is keep it simple. There's lots of connectors that will work, as you can hear. And let us know, Brandon, do you already have the RG6 or are you thinking of buying it? In which case, the RG8 Mini might be a little easier, but you have the choices. Lots of things will work. KB1, THM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KB1, THM. Yeah, right now, actually, I'm using RG8X and about 25 feet of it. And I found that it was just kind of expensive. This little 25 feet, it was like $20 with the connectors already on it. So I don't know. But I think I have a ton of RG6, like spools laying all over the place in the basement. And I do have experience putting the F connectors on, and I went on RadioShack.com right now, and they have a F to PL259 adapter for $5, so that might be a good way to do it, like you said. So I think I'll probably go that way. And doing this, won't it give me an impedance of 1.5 to 5?
Assuming the antenna is a pure 50-ohm load, and a good design comes very close, and assuming your cable was, I'm going to pick a number, 75 ohms, the way you calculate what is the standing wave ratio in that situation would be 75 divided by 50, and the answer is 1.5. You're absolutely right. 1.50. 1.521 standing wave ratio. You go to the right chart, you'll find out that creates an insertion loss of approximately 0.2 of a dB, which, as I said, on your signal strength meter of your receiver, if you had the old-fashioned needle movement, that would be equivalent to the width of the needle. You couldn't see it without a magnifying glass at my age. So don't worry about it. Don't worry about the impedance match of 50 versus 75. You're listening to a piece of 75-ohm cable right now, which I've used for the last 15 years or so on this tower. I've used it for all of the techniques, and I've done no compensating of any kind on both ends. So keep it simple at first. You can always add the elaboration later. Let me drop. And as you do select a cable, select a connector, select adapters, connect it to your antenna and whatever, come back and let us know how it worked out, Brandon. And one of the things that I've heard during the week is that you had some strong statements said to you that 60 watts into an antenna 6 feet away from you is dangerous. It's not quite. You actually do the calculation, and it turns out to be 3 microwatts per square centimeter, and 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is the safety factor. So by the current United States standard, which is almost identical to the one in the United Kingdom and many other countries, even 6 feet away and 60 watts into it is not super safe, but it already is something like a 20-to-1 ratio below the current standard for maximum permitted exposure. I'd strongly recommend you keep the antenna further away from you than that, but if for a short period of time under emergency conditions you have to operate an antenna with 50 watts of 2 meter energy into it 6 feet away, believe it or not, the calculation says it's safe. I know there are people who will differ with that an awful lot, but the real bottom line so far is milliwatts per square centimeter until somebody comes up with a better test indicating something else. And that particular test I'm describing has 60 years of history behind it. Back to you for any final comments, Brandon. KB1THM, glad you signed in tonight. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, but Brandon first. Go ahead, Glenn. I mean, Brandon.
Okay, yeah. Actually, just about 2 days ago, I moved my antenna, and now I have it outside in the garden with a piece of about 15 feet of PVC sticking up in the air, and it's sitting on top of that. So it's a good 20 feet away from me, and I'm in a house that's made of stone, and the walls are a good 4 feet thick, so I don't think I should be running into any of those maximum exposure limit problems. But, yeah. One thing is, I think I need to feel that connector I have a little better, because it's outside, and right now I just have plastic wrapped very, very tightly around it, but I really don't think that'll be enough. Do you have any good, do you recommend anything good?
Yes, I do. I think Radio Shack sells it, and if not, you can buy it in a Home Depot store. It's called Duct Seal, D-U-C-T Seal. It comes in a brick, so to speak. It's a black plastic-like material, and the brick is about 6 inches long and 3 inches wide, and it costs a couple of dollars. You peel off a piece of it, and you mold this clay-like substance around the connector, and then wrap the electrical tape or the plastic tape on top of that. That does a better job. A guy who does a skilled job with just plastic tape usually can do a good enough weather sealing for a couple of years. If the antenna is going to be on top of a tower and you're not going to get a chance to touch it for the next 10 years, you should do something a little bit more enthusiastic. But weatherproofing and keeping the water out of the connector is fairly important. Also consider things like elastic adhesive squirted in the right places to make sure that water cannot crawl down the inside of the connector where the top of the antenna is, things like that. And you may have to wait. Let me drop.
To me, Dick, then I'll give them the answer.
Okay. You may have to wait until the elastic adhesive dries a little bit because it is slightly conductive when it's wet. We've got Glenn and Mel in that order. I want to give some further comments. KC2QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody. Just a comment about the, the 75-ohm cable and eventually, adapting it to PL259 and operating the system at 50 ohms. One of the things I've done in the past is a lot of times is to try to retune the antenna a little bit. A lot of ground plane antennas or some of the base-mounted antennas give you a little bit of adjustment range. You can adjust the center of the whip. Sometimes the ground plane radial kit sometimes has a little bit of adjustment to it. And instead of there being a 1.5-to-1 ratio, you might be able to get something a little bit better by measuring the VSWR and adjusting the antenna itself, and you might be able to get something quite a bit better than 1.5-to-1. Another thing, too, is something I've done with installations is I use a little bit of the RTD silicone corking, so things used normally for, like, tub and tile. And that also makes a very, very good seal. You just squeeze the RTD around one of those outside connections, and it seals it up pretty good when it dries. It's like silicone rubber drying right around it. Now let me pass it back to you, Dick, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WS2N.
All recognized, and you're going to be right after Mel. That's another good suggestion, Glenn, and that is I wouldn't do it right away. And by the way, a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio through a reasonable length of cable on 2 meters or 450 megacycles is a beautiful antenna. Stop worrying about it. But if you want it to be a little bit better and you got the right kind of instrumentation, you can bend the radials down. That raises the impedance of the antenna. And there's other various tricks you can do. There's ways you can do rather simple things to the antenna to make it the 70 ohms that you want it to be. So should you use a stub or just correct the problem directly at the antenna, that's your choice. Weatherproofing, as I said, we've already talked about caulking compounds. They work very well. Elastic adhesive, they work very well. Let's see what Mel's got to say on weatherproofing techniques. I bet you those guys on Dover Street know how to keep all that salt spray you get from the Manhattan Beach area. Must give you some significant salt spray from time to time, and you find ways to live without having you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
M2EO.
Rich recognized after the group. You got it, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Brandon, go to RadioWorks.com. And you'll see stuff called coax seal, very cheap stuff that they sell. It's a type of stuff that you wrap around, you mold it around like you would do a piece of clay. It's called coax seal. It's also used by the telephone guys. So if you know of a guy that's working for the telephone company, you could ask him for a piece of if it comes on a strip of paper, like paper, because it's so gummy that it's got like paper on each side so that you can peel it. You peel the paper off and then you just take the stuff and mold it around, and just by itself coax seal is the best. I've taken the Nexus part pulled off the stuff that's been out there for years, and they are shiny and new as like they like the day I installed it. So, RadioWorks.com. First of all, you can get a brochure from them. They got all kinds of interesting antennas and supplies in there. So, if you're not familiar with it, take a look at RadioWorks.com. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, guys, I'm going to say 7-3. I'm going to go to bed. So I'll listen out for a minute. So 731-THM. And I think I'll look into doing that.
Yeah, do come back and tell us what you how it all works out, Brandon, even if it works out well or not. The last comment I wanted to make to you is that a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio on a 2-meter rig is extremely good. A 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio on an 80-to-10-meter no-tune rig is not so good. Those rigs are much more persnickety, much more non-forgiving of even a 1.5 standing wave ratio. But a 2-meter rig, anything less than 3-to-1, they keep right on cranking, with rare exceptions. So don't worry about that, all that impedance matching. Good luck, and as I said, please come back and tell us how it goes. Paul was the next person on the list, and after that it's going to be Rich. Paul first, WS2N, and tell me while you're there what's going on in space, Paul. I mean, tell me that you're going to have a space report or not. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, we'll have a space report whenever you like. But I just want to mention the duct seal. I've been using the duct seal. It comes in a roll, similar to what Mel said. You know, it's got paper, so it's almost like a tape. And you know, you put it on, you peel the paper off. But this, you know, it's actually duct seal. You can get them in the plumbing supply houses. He's not on Long Island, but Blackman and Shapiro or any local plumbing supply house usually has that. It's a, you know, a roll instead of a block, or you know, it's very very nice. You can just wrap it around the connectors, you know, squeeze it, and then do what you said, you know, put tape over it if you like, and it stays like forever. You really have to put some tape on, because if you don't, when the heat starts heating it up, it wants to drip. So you have to like hold it back from, you know, from the hot weather. That's one problem with the duct seal. Works great, but you do have to encapsulate it in some kind of tape. Back to you, Dick.
Good suggestion. Yeah, that duct seal comes in nice thin strips with the paper in between, and it's very convenient to use. I bet your Rich has used that stuff. And those guys in Whitestone, they know how to keep water out. N2EO. Nice picture you've got on QRZ.com. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich, and wait for the beep.
E2EJ, portable 7. Oh, Eric recognized portable 7, N2EO. Okay, Dick, what I wanted to say was I had read years ago in QST, they warned you not to use silicone rubber to seal coaxial cable. That vinegary smell is acetic acid, and they stated what happens is when you seal connectors with that type of material, the acetic acid leaches into the cable, and it can't get out because it's now sealed. And it totally contaminates the cable, and the losses go way up. So don't use silicone rubber, or don't use any of those materials that have that vinegary smell. That's acetic acid. No good. Dick, Radio Shack used to sell coax seal. They were repackaging it, same red and white box, and they were calling it Radio Shack antenna sealant. But they stopped selling it. I wish they hadn't done that. It was a good product. They were getting the same price as Radio Works, but I guess the beat counters at Radio Shack decided not to sell it. Also, what I wanted to say, the best thing is electrical tape, very fine, what do they call it, Scotch Plus 3 electrical tape, and Scotch coat. Trouble is, the Scotch coat is very hard to get. You go to the average hardware store, they think you mean Scotch Guard. I have to say, no, Scotch coat. I haven't been able to find it in quite a long time. But that's really the best way to seal connectors. Back to that at 2EO.
Other Tesco, WD2HW. Tesco Communications or Cartwright Communications.
When you do wrap the tape, and we're going to go over to Eric right next. When you do wrap the tape with a plastic tape that you're stretching pretty tight to make it do a good sealing job over your coaxial or whatever, at the end of the tape, do not pull it to breakage. You do that, you damage the end of the tape, and it starts unraveling from your connector. The last bit of tape on the end of the roll, the tape that you're about to cut off, so to speak, to end the tape wrapping job on your connector, cut that with a pair of scissors or with your Swiss Army knife. Do not stretch it until breakage. It's a quick and fast way to do it, but within a year it will start unraveling because you've damaged the end of the tape. Now, Eric has gone to the National Association of Broadcasters convention. I think it's in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's where I think he is. I sure hope we haven't timed out the machine so he's still there. KE2EJ, I bet you're having a blast. K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ, yes, I'm in Las Vegas, and the show doesn't actually go open until tomorrow. But what I was going to say was actually what Rich had already told you is don't use silicone steel on coax connectors. Use it on your stainless steel fittings and stuff like that for your antenna. It keeps it banking new, but what we tend to do is we use a non-water-based silicone grease. Grease, not steel. And then very wide black tape. Actually, 3M makes 3-inch and 4-inch wide electrical tape. And we wrap that stuff with a thin layer of the silicone grease on. And then wrap the wire tape around it. And if you're fortunate enough to have a can of Scotch coat, which you can get from 3M, by the way, Rich. It's still available. You just have to get it from the right place, that's all. And you're good to go for about 20 years, so. I will let you know about the convention after it opens on Monday, but all the PBS folks I've run into, and they're doing some interesting stuff. Back to you, Dick, and try and leave a little more space so I can get in there. K2RIW, K2J, Portable 7.
K7XX.
7XX, question mark. We'll go to you in a second. K2RIW. I wonder, have you heard some timeouts tonight, Eric, or was the machine pretty consistent out there in Las Vegas? Eric to pick it up, and he's going to pass it over to 7XX. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ, Portable 7. Yeah, I haven't timed out. I've got it set, and I think with the last changes I made, it has made it a little more stable. So you just really need to leave a little more space so somebody else can get in there. So, you know, that's the story. Let's turn it over to 7SF and let him pick it up.
Good evening, gentlemen. The name here is Luke, Lima Uniform Kilo Echo. I'm also in Vegas on a different machine as RIW. Just heading down the freeway, and I jumped into this net sort of late, so I don't know if you covered it or not, but there's a product out there also that kind of goes along with the UNV-104 coax seal, and it's called CRS Stuff. It's a tube of stuff. It doesn't have any silicone material or anything to hurt the center dielectric of the cable or the outer jacket, but what you do is you just squirt a little bit of it inside of the PL259 connector or end connector and screw it down, and as you screw it down, it forces itself through all the little channels and voids in the thread and seals it from your connection from the inside out. And then to top it off, you can cover your connector up with UNV-104, the 104 stuff, or any of the other things that you mentioned. Back to Net. This is Luke.
Thank you, Luke. Luke out in Las Vegas, Nevada. I think he's running Mobile. And he says he's going through a slightly different repeater. Okay, that's CRS stuff. I've seen it.
It is a white, pasty material. I think it's made out of something like little balls of polystyrene, or maybe they're Teflon in some kind of a fluid medium. You squirt it in the middle of your connector. It has a very low dielectric constant, so it only does an extremely small amount of change of the impedance of the connector. But if you fill up all of the air spaces inside of your connector before you mate the male and the female, the theory on that is that if you fill up all the air spaces, let me drop. If you fill up all the air spaces, then the water has no chance to get in there, and therefore doesn't give you a water intrusion problem inside of the connector. One of the things you've got to worry about that's not quite obvious is that every outdoor connector we've got is going to experience a temperature extremes. The worst case situation is a hot summer day with the sun beating on the connector. Therefore, whatever air inside of the connector is in the hot expanded mode. All of a sudden, a sudden summer shower comes along, and cold water hits the outside of the connector. The air inside contracts, and therefore it sucks in the water that's already there on the outside of the connector. So you see the mechanism by which water can easily get into connectors. So even though you think you've done an extremely good sealing job, because every connector breathes to some amount, hot and cold days, water has nasty ways of getting in there. Got to be kind of sure to get it out. Let me drop. I said get it out. You got to be careful to keep it out. Okay, the next person on our list was Wesley, N2XJN. And we finally got to you, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RAW. What would you like to talk about tonight?
November to X-ray, Juliet, November. Are you getting me good?
I'm getting you very good, so please proceed and do a better job than I do, Wesley, of watching your watch and waiting long enough for a couple of seconds after the beep.
Okay, this is Andrew Adrian. Well, I was preparing myself to doing some project, and I mentioned earlier that I'm preparing myself to do this project, and then I thought that you were talking about antennas and educating people, but at the same time, a few of them might have been very much aware of certain measurement tools, and one of them is a oscilloscope. And I would like you to say something about the bandwidth of oscilloscope. I mean, something that actually says about the oscilloscope so everybody understands it, because the price of these devices is really, really not a high one. What is the sampling? What is the real time sampling? And what is the difference with the quality equivalent time sampling and the sample memory rate? Something like that. Bacteria, that's it.
I think of all the years of the TechNet, oscilloscopes, which are an extremely handy tool, we've talked about very little. And so hopefully we're about to correct that, Wesley. Maybe you haven't been here all those years, but somehow you knew. Voltage versus time is what an oscilloscope displays for you. And they do an extremely good job. In other words, if you're looking at the output of an audio oscillator and you want to look at how clean is the sine wave, or are there any flat tops, crossover distortion, a good oscilloscope will show that to you. It displays voltage, usually vertically, and time horizontally. And because it has a built-in synchronization circuit, as long as you have a repetitive waveform and you properly set the sync circuit, you can usually make any repetitive waveform sit still on that screen, similar to a stroboscope. That's what's really going on. There may be 60 cycles per second going through there, and you can make a nice steady picture out of it by the way you synchronize the scope. And good oscilloscopes these days will go to numbers like approximately 350 megacycles. That's about the maximum. So you could display with the right kind of a scope probe. Let me drop. With the right kind of a scope probe, you could display the output of your 2-meter transmitter directly on the oscilloscope as a voltage versus time display. And with a single sideband transmitter, where you now use the oscilloscope in a slightly different way, you put the audio into the horizontal plates and put the RF into the vertical plates, you'll get a beautiful diamond-like display that will show you what is the linearity of the way you're setting your oscilloscope. Now, the old-fashioned oscilloscopes that had a cathode ray tube, as I said, would go up to 350 megacycles if you buy the right one. Very few of them go that far. Almost all of them near the end of using cathode ray tubes would go to 150 megacycles. Nowadays, everyone wants a small, solid-state, flat screen on the oscilloscope, and life becomes a little bit more complicated. Let me drop. The reason life becomes a little more complicated is because a well-designed cathode ray tube-type oscilloscope, you're able to sweep those electrons across the phosphor, which lights up and gives you the display. You can sweep those light electrons across there with a well-made oscilloscope. Some of the Tektronix models are some of the very good ones. For instance, 150 megacycles of display is relatively easy. Beyond that, it starts getting hard, and a few of them could go to 350 megacycles. The flat screen liquid crystal displays don't have anywhere near that speed. Therefore, you now are putting the data for the display in something called a display matrix. It's kind of an internal memory, and you're painting your signal into that internal memory, and then at a much slower speed, you're printing out the internal memory into the flat screen display. At first, that sounds like a fairly simple electronic process. Unfortunately, there are a few situations where the difference in the timing of putting the signal into the display and the difference in the timing of the way the display memory is put onto the flat screen can give you some peculiar problems where you get artifacts in the signal or certain kinds of only partially repetitive signals will... what's the right word for it now? They start looking a little bit funny, is one way of looking at it. Or another way of looking at it, let me drop, is that if you're trying to catch a transient phenomenon, in the case of a cathode ray tube oscilloscope, it's relatively easy to catch the phenomenon. In the case of a flat screen oscilloscope, it could be very difficult. You may miss it a whole lot of times because the timing of what's going on, you're painting the signal into a display matrix and displaying it out so slow, you could say that in the time domain, something like 1% of the information in the time domain is being displayed on a flat screen scope. And the other 99% of the time got missed between the painting process onto the display matrix and the way it's displayed on the screen. There are ways around this, but you've got to be careful. You've got to know that there's a potential limitation. I ran into this problem headlong 2 years ago where I had a project where I had to catch a transient phenomena onto a spectrum analyzer. A spectrum analyzer is a kind of oscilloscope where the horizontal axis, you're sweeping frequency instead of sweeping time. But other than that, there's a fairly strong similarity between an oscilloscope and a spectrum analyzer. Let me drop. And I had an application where I had to catch a transient phenomena. I was looking at the third order intermodulation distortion for a particular environment where a certain kind of a circuit would give you blasts of intermodulation distortion, but only periodically. It was a random event. And to display it on an old-fashioned oscilloscope of a spectrum analyzer was very easy. The modern-day solid-state spectrum analyzers that have a flat screen, a narrow screen, a compact screen, shall we say, most of the time the signal I was looking for was not there. So when you have something that is not truly repetitive, the modern-day lighter instruments have got some real problems to them. But now, Wesley also asked about a so-called sampling oscilloscope. which is what I'm going to try to describe somewhat briefly next.
I said only about the features of the oscilloscope, and some of them is sampling, and what is the difference between equivalent time sampling and real time sampling, and why the equivalent one is a grabby, shoddy, and cheating. Back to you.
The waveform doesn't have to be repetitive, Dick. Okay, whoever said the waveform doesn't have to be repetitive, if I've got a transient event that only occurs randomly and I don't know when, and it occurs 1% of the time, and if I'm looking at it with a modern-day flat-screen scope, or if I'm attempting to look at it with a sampling oscilloscope, tell me how you would do that. The person who said that, please identify yourself. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
It's Ed, Dick. I thought you meant by repetitive a sine wave or a square wave. You can look at a single pulse because you can trigger the start of the trace by the pulse going negative or positive over.
Yes, that will give you the triggering and the starting of the event. KC2QIQ also recognized. But if the event is something beyond a few, if it's more brief than a few nanoseconds, and you want to catch it and display it on that screen of a modern-day scope, it could be very troublesome. If you can force the event to be truly repetitive, then life becomes a lot easier. We haven't talked about sampling oscilloscope yet, but I think Glenn wants to talk about what we've said so far. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, Dick. This is something that a lot of times without a sampling scope, and you just want to take a, you have something that occasionally happens, and you could have a repetitive waveform in the background, and then a spike that happens on top of it every once in a while. And you don't want to stop the oscilloscope on the repetitive waveform or on a DC level. You just want to catch that occasional spike. And generally how I do that is I'll take the scope out of the auto-triggering mode, and I put it into normal trigger. Then what I'll do is I'll make an estimate, a basic idea of how high or the amplitude that I would expect the signal to be, the transient signal, and I'll set the trigger level to that fixed point. Then put the scope into what I call the single sweep mode. And then basically what I'll do is I'll connect it up to the circuit, and the next time that that pulse passes by and hits that triggering level for the trigger, it will give me one sample or one sweep of that signal, and then hold it and freeze it on the screen. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
With what you just described, Glenn, what do you believe is the briefest event you could display in that manner? If I had a spike that I want to see the waveform of the spike, and the spike is 8/10 of a nanosecond long, do you believe you'd be able to display that with a modern-day oscilloscope of the kind you're describing? And also, mention a brand name and a model number if you happen to know. But the 8/10 of a nanosecond event, would I be able to display that on the screen if it happened once? Over to you, Glenn.
It depends from the sampling frequency.
Well, my feeling is, you know, 8/10 of a nanosecond, you're talking about a 1 nanosecond signal. Now, I mean, at that point in time, you're all the way at the end of your time base. I mean, even on a 400 megahertz Tektronix scope, one of the latest ones, I don't think it's going to be a display issue. It's just going to be that you've already got the scope all the way at the very, very end of your time base. Is it possible to catch it? I think with enough experimentation, it's not going to be easy. But yeah, you could do it. As long as you have a pretty good guessing estimation of where that trigger level point is or the amplitude, it should hit the trigger. And if you have it in the... See, the only thing that can give you trouble there a lot of times is if there's like another signal running in between it that could give you the false trigger. So when you're trying to do a single sweep, basically you have to have the trigger level just high enough so it doesn't get triggered by anything else, and that the one signal that goes by catches it. Is it possible to? Yes. Is it going to be easy? Oh, no. That's why you get paid the big bucks, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Now, the scope that you've set, and you're absolutely right, if you set the trigger just right so that it catches the one big nasty spike that you're looking for and rejecting everything else, and you set the threshold of triggering and the mode of triggering correctly on an old-fashioned oscilloscope with a cathode ray tube, K2 getting that onto the screen. And then, I said old fashioned cathode ray tube. You better be using it with a camera with the lens open, and because the screen doesn't have persistence, there's a whole lot of problem. With modern day oscilloscopes, where a liquid crystal screen itself is extremely slow, but the display matrix can capture the event. So I think you're saying a modern day flat screen, solid state screen type of oscilloscope, you believe you'd be able to paint that single event onto the display matrix and therefore have it continuously painted onto the liquid crystal screen, and therefore you could see it, store it, photograph it, whatever. What model number and brand name of oscilloscope of that type are you now using, Glenn? KC2QIQ? Also, how many bucks? K2RIW?
K2XJN.
Here we go.
Well, everybody recognized, but I did give enough time there, Dick. The Tektronix that I'm using right now, my God, I wish I remembered the name of the number off the top of my head. And it's not all that, I mean, okay, let's say, I think they're right now, they're selling somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000. And they're 400 megahertz Tektronix scopes. And the issue is, I don't think it's going to be the display that's the issue. What happens is, as long as you're in the correct time base, in other words, if you were in a very, very slow moving, like let's say a 1 millisecond time base, and you're trying to trigger something in 1 nanosecond, yes, by the time you trigger it and you try to open up the display, there's not going to be enough points along of data at that point when you try to expand it to see it. So all you're going to see is maybe a couple of dots, even though it does catch it. The idea is that if you get the time base all the way out into the, so that basically you're like, we'll say 1 nanosecond per centimeter across your screen, and a 1 nanosecond waveform goes by, or a 8 tenths of a nanosecond goes by, it should capture most of it. And then you'll have the full resolution within that one nanosecond per centimeter going across the screen. But the hard part is that when you try to center a very, very narrow event like that by itself, that's where catching it is going to be the hard part. But as long as you're in the right time base, you know, which if you've got it opened up all the way so that you should be centered, and you've got your trigger sent to the center of the screen, and you've got the right trigger point, you should be able to catch it, Dick. And if it catches it within that resolution, you should have enough points on the screen to give you a nice clear picture.
I think when it comes to very exotic oscilloscopes, the broadcast industry uses them. Let me skip over everybody and let's see what Eric has got to say on this one. Then I'm going to pick up everyone else. Don't worry. We're going to get you guys. KE2EJ. I bet you've used some fancy scopes for catching transient events. Go ahead, Eric. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, Roger, Dick. KRIWK2J. I use a Tektronix PDS360. It's a 500 megahertz scope. I can literally put the whole thing under my armpit. It's nice and small. But there's a couple of modes that you can actually, I can capture things that are 1 nanosecond wide that occur every once every 10 seconds. Of course, you have the issue of triggering, but there is some software in the scope that will do several things. One is it will create persistence for you, whereas it will continuously capture a continuous input signal, and it's as though you use a delayed trigger, and you can actually walk your way through it, and you can break it out in time from, say, the start of a measurement period to an end of a measurement period, which could be 10 seconds or 100 seconds. It all depends on how much memory you put in the scope. There's also a function that creates persistence. So if something is occurring and it's continually rewrite on the screen, like a slow phosphor, there's a lot of little tricks you can do. But really, is the understanding of how the scope operates.
And by the way, tell us, how expensive is that machine?
I will have a beginning period of time that I am interested in, and for me, typically, it will be across the television line, which is 64 microseconds. I may want to examine something that's going on inside that particular period of time. So I have a trigger that always occurs at the same time. I'm not really interested in capturing anything that in that particular period of time, which I would call retrace, but you can continuously record, you're literally recording linearly that input signal, and it gives you the opportunity to go through it and examine it. And even if you have something that is there that's within the resolution of the scope, you should be able to find it and see it. The problems that you're talking about really are real-time issues, whereas the LCD screens are very slow. They don't have persistence. They take time for the signal to appear, so to speak. And something that goes by very fast will not, the state of the liquid crystal will not change fast enough for you to see it, even though you're electrically feeding it to the display. K2RIW, K2JUST.
K2JUST.
Next person I heard was Mel, and we'll eventually find out how expensive is that TDS 360 500 megacycle oscilloscope that Eric just told us about. But for those who tuned in late, Las Vegas, Nevada, and so he's getting a first-hand use of the remote sensing, the remote inputs of this particular machine. Go ahead, Mel. K2KEY. I bet you've used some fancy scopes in your time. K2RIW.
Thanks, Ian.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, okay. Let me tell you the story on it. The one he's talking about, I know the scope fairly well, the TDS series, because my last job I used the TDS 640 scope, which is a nice, beautiful piece of equipment. Digital, real-time, electronics described it. And it works magnificently well. A scope that's a little pricey, but a phenomenal piece of equipment. The one I own, I bought the older one, which I think I like better, because it's got a CRT, and that is the old version, which was a digital storage scope called the Tektronix 466 DIC. If you want me to say some more, go ahead.
I'm going to guess that the Tektronix 466 might be a cathode ray type, and when it comes to that TDS series, I think those are the ones that have multiple colors of the multiple channels. In other words, you can display 2, 3, 4 signals at a time, where each signal on the screen has its own color. And my goodness, can you have a lot of fun with that? Go ahead, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, Roger, 4 channels, 500 megahertz, and 2 gigs of sampling rate. Let me remember, sweep speed, 500 PS, division, 10 to, oh, gee. I don't remember, at a vertical sensitivity, around 1 microvolt, and so on and so forth. The vertical resolution was in bits, called the 8-bit sampling system. And record length, I think it was 2K per channel, if I remember the mistake, something like that. But it was you could make a hard copy format from this. You could print right off the screen, Dick. Phenomenal instrument. And like I say, very pricey, over.
DC2QAQ with the model number.
Enter, Ian.
Go ahead, Glenn, with that model number.
Yeah, the scope you said will definitely do it for you. The one that I have in work is the TDS-3000C, made by Tektronix. It's called the Digital Phosphor Oscilloscope Series. This thing's really pretty neat, Dick, and it doesn't cost a king's fortune either. As a matter of fact, if you have a chance to sample one, have the guys drop one off for you to try for a week or so, it's definitely worth doing, I think.
Now, a little bit about what you guys have been hearing. Is that the word sampling oscilloscope and how much memory depth? There are kinds of oscilloscopes which are continuously digitizing the input signal with anywhere from 8 to 12 or even 16 bits of digitization, and they're doing it at some ridiculously high rate of megacycles per sample, and therefore all that sampled data is going into the memory of the scope, and the memory is being played out
onto the screen at a much slower rate. Some of these scopes can really display some fancy things. That's one